All right, what's up, my Siggers? Bloody hell. Okay. So we had a bit of a false start. Thanks a lot again to Dangerfield for the previous stream. I wanted to look at this video by Tony Blair, speech he gave recently. A lot of people have said that I don't really talk about the cigars anymore. The last cigar I had was a Quorum, which was a Nicaraguan cigar, the one on the previous stream. Nothing to write home about, very average. But for this one, I'm back to the Cubans. And it's a Por La Laranga. Por La Laranga. It's a Cuban cigar from Habana. It's one of those long, thin ones. So you can imagine me sitting here somewhat like the penguin from Batman or something like that. And I'm drinking it with a craft beer, a honey beer called Hiva, which I bought from Marks and Sparks. In fact, I was drinking it through the last stream as well. I'm about halfway through with that, just as an accompaniment to the cigars. Somebody said, "Who cares about the cigars, really?" Well, there are some people who genuinely want to hear my views on the cigars. And given that I've been denying them my incisive analysis of cigars recently, I thought I'd give it. Now, speaking of incisive analysis, I came across this speech that Tony Blair did just a couple of days ago. He did it on the 20th of February, on celebrating 120 years of the Labour Party. And it was a good reminder, I think, of what a kind of genius political operator Blair was and still is, and really what our genuine enemy is on the left. What are if the left in its kind of most effective and insidious form, what would they be like to fight against? And actually, a reminder that it's actually better to have the left in its Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders form, its current kind of insane form, than in its Blair form. You've got to remember this man, he basically destroyed this nation. I'm not just talking about the war, I'm talking about the cultural revolution he enacted. I'm talking about his subversion of the police, his subversion of crime statistics, his subversion of the way the law works, his subversion of every single institution of the education system, you name it, Blair was instrumental. And of course, his role in bringing about mass immigration. And don't forget, underestimated the target of 50% of everybody in university, where they go to get, where they go to get brainwashed in all the Marxist theory that we've been talking about on this channel. Again, that was Tony Blair. So all of these things, I mean, so many of the things we rail about were set up in the Blair era. The legislation that got Count Dankula arrested and fined was brought in by Tony Blair. All of those amendments to the 1986 the 1986 Act that we talked about, that was Blair. So he is not to be underestimated. He is, in fact, what I'm calling a Machiavellian genius. How did he manage to do this against the wills of millions and millions of people in this country? How did he manage to get, all of the majority of people in this country to vote for him three times in a row? And this video, I think, this speech of his is a rare opportunity to see, I guess, some of Blair's true power levels. I'll just put it that way. Now, I hate Tony Blair. A lot of people are watching this channel will hate Tony Blair. But I think, despite the fact that the man is basically evil, we can still appreciate that he is an extremely canny operator, and that I tried to explain this before. If you were to make a Tony Blair football manager style kind of profile, rating him out of 20 for each of the skills a politician needs, he would be a very, very highly rated card. If it was politicians' top trumps, he has got a lot of skills. Very good communicator, expert at framing issues, great on strategy, great at optics, great at sound bites, great at hiding his true motivation. So let's all of those things in mind, let us have a look at this. So I'm going to, you're going to have to help me here, chat. And a lot of people have sent super chats already. I've just seen the previous stream had two super chats, so let me get those out of the way now, and then we'll do it. Coney, current year, says second stream where I tell you to stop being fat. Sigh. Jack says Real Madrid or Barcelona. To be honest, I don't know at this point, but let's just say Real. It's I stopped watching football a good while ago now. It's just hard. I just it's hard for me not to see it any as anything more than part of propaganda efforts, to be honest, at this point. But El Clasico is always a big game. Christian Verti says AA joins the boomer audio regime, indeed. And Coney says third stream in which I tell you that you're fat. I mean, he's going to keep on doing this, but it's not going to work, mate. It's not going to work. Buy sugar butter, and avoid the third biscuit. Okay, so you're going to have to tell me in the chat whether this is working or not. So I'm going to share my screen. And then I'm going to turn the audio on, and hopefully you'll be able to hear what I am hearing. So let's play this. Just
Ask you to
press one in the
welcome
chat if you can hear
Tony
this.
Blair.
Right, tell me if you just hear that little bit of audio there. Yeah, okay, so you can hear it. Brilliant. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this, and then I'm going to stop and give like on the fly analysis. All right, so let's go with that. If I cut out like I did before, it's because I'm down in the garage and I may need to reconnect to the BT Wi-Fi. That's why that happens sometimes. All right, so let's take it away.
Pleasure to be with you here. Thanks to King's for hosting this lecture. Thank you, Andrew, who apparently used to work for my wife in Downing Street 20 years ago.
Classic Blair move, ingratiate himself to the room by making a personal connection to the guy who introduced him. Could have just said, oh, thanks, and carried on. But look, he said he's making a personal connection here, which is, you know, the subtext of this is, I'm a really nice guy. I'm the sort of person who remembers that this chap used to work for my wife. You know, let's carry on.
You must have been about 12, actually, looking at you now. But and thank you for reminding me of my very first and wholly unsuccessful political outing, which was in Beaconsfield in 1982. It was memorable for two things, actually. First of all, my dad came and canvassed for me, and my dad had been a conservative all his life. And I had to reprimand him about halfway through the campaign when I found he was actually using the Conservative Party talking points on the doorstep rather than the Labour ones.
And that's ironic, of course, because that's literally what Blair did so many times, is he used Tory talking points to get himself elected. But let's keep on going.
And the other thing I remember was knocking on a door, and because Beaconsfield was a very posh place, right? And I knocked on a door of a large house, and the woman answered the door, and I said, I'm from the Labour Party. She looked at me, and then she shouted to her husband and said, darling, you must come and see this man. He says he's from the Labour Party. I've never seen one of those before. And they then came and studied me as if I was some weird exhibit. And I said to her, well, do you think you might be voting Labour? And she said, oh, my dear, absolutely not. So that was, I lost that campaign, by the way, pretty comprehensively. So 120 years old. I thought hard about taking stock on the Labour Party's 120th anniversary. It's not as if my advice is particularly welcome to today's party. But then it occurred to me that there were actually only two people born in the last 120 years who have won an election for Labour. And alas, Harold Wilson is long gone. As for the other two leaders to have won an election, Ramsay MacDonald was born in 1866 and Clement Attlee in 1883. So out of the 120 years, Labour has been in power for just over 30 of them. That is a stark statistic. We now have another Tory government for 5 years and possibly for 10.
So again, a classic Blair move. He's starting with some facts that are undeniable. So you're with him. You're buying into the fact that this guy's telling the truth already. And nothing he said at the moment can be denied.
Were that to happen, Labour would have been in office for less than one quarter of its entire existence.
Just from our point of view, what a damning indictment of the Tory party that is. Think of all the things that they didn't change. They've been in power for all of it. So that's that really is remarkable.
Bluntly, what Labour has stood for in terms of values has been magnificent. Its achievements in government huge. But as a political competitor, it has too often been a failure. It has only once been elected for two successive full terms, only once for three, both as New Labour, a period much of today's party wants to disown. As Glenn O'Hara shows in the excellent pamphlet on Labour history published today, during that 120 years, Labour has spent long stretches in opposition, elected spasmodically so the Conservatives could take a breather before the natural order of things resumed, i.e. a Tory government. Labour, when it has won, has always won because it secured the centre of British politics.
Now, that's a fact. And that's something I've tried to explain before, that the left, to win, need to tack to the centre, whereas I'm not convinced that the right do at all. This is what I think the Tories always get wrong and people like the British get wrong. I don't think the right needs to tack to the centre at all, because most people are on the right. It's the left you need to moderate. It's the left you need to come to the centre. Tony Blair understands this, but I'm not sure if all people do.
Addressed the future and broadened its appeal. And yet, despite this obviously being true, we've exhibited an extraordinary attachment to retreating into a narrow part of the left, which has always ended in defeat. Then, when defeated, we say, we will listen to the people. And for a short time, we do. Before we decide that what they're saying is too uncomfortable and lapse into our comfort zone, only to edge with agonized slowness back to where we should have been in the first place. Our latest defeat was entirely predictable and predicted. We went into the election with a leader with a minus 40% net approval rating, on political terrain chosen by our opponents, with a manifesto promising the earth.
Note the bit where he says political terrain chosen by our opponents, because if you remember at the time, it was Blair, it was Alistair Campbell, it was Mandelson who was saying, don't let Boris have the election. Hold off. Keep this rotten parliament going for as long as we can. Because they knew that as long as that was the terrain, they held strings to power. So this is like truly Machiavellian thinking from Blair. And he knows it was a massive victory for the Tories just to have the election at all. Let's keep on going.
But from a planet other than Earth, and a campaign which substituted a narcissistic belief in our righteousness for professionalism. So here we are, back where we were before, and before that, and before that. And the public is watching the current leadership contest. I know it's not big news, because that belongs to government, because governments do things and oppositions only say things.
Note his stress here on, you need to be in power. You need power to enact your change. You need to be in government. Embrace power. Take the reins of power. This is a very strong through line of what he's already been saying so far. And it's again, classic Machiavellian thinking, but he's absolutely correct. From the left's point of view, from Labour's point of view, they need to actually be in power to do some of the radical things they want. Of course, we know the Tories will kind of do the same thing at the speed limit, but that's by the by. Let's keep on going.
But the public have half an ear cocked. They're waiting to see if we get it. And they're willingest to succeed, by the way. They want a strong alternative. They know the country needs an opposition. And I know that when you're running for party leadership, you're talking to your activists, you're enthusing your base, you are carefully calibrating with the consoling, but we are in crisis, and at a time when progressive politics is in crisis virtually everywhere. See last night's debate in the US.
See, he knows. He knows that the left are in trouble. He knows the center left are in trouble. He knows that populism is rising. He knows that nationalism is doing well. He knows that people, voices like his, are starting not to be listened to. Really important recognition from Blair, but it's also dangerous because it shows that the true elites, the real, you know, the managerial elites I talk about, the money men, the Davos crowd, they're very aware of what's happening. And look at him trying to control where things go now. It's very interesting to see this. Let's carry on.
In countries with populations of over 20 million, there is not one traditional left Western party in majority power, and few even in coalition. Progressives risk confining ourselves within four walls of impotence. Old-style tax and spend, state power economics, foreign policy easily characterized as anti-Western, embrace of identity politics, and shouty denunciation of anyone who disagrees with us.
Now let's stop there. All four of those points are talking points that people like Sargon have been making since 2014, 2015. Every single point there, most members of this chat would agree with. Virtually nobody watching this would disagree with what he's saying because it is an accurate analysis of the problem. Let's see where he goes.
The first misreads the lessons of the financial crisis. The second, of post 9/11. The third sees us joining a culture war, which we are absolutely certain to lose if we do it.
You see, he knows. He knows the left will lose a culture war with the right in the current circumstances. And that's really interesting that Blair recognizes this, but, you know, the activists in the Labour Party don't.
And the fourth encourages us to emulate the right-wing populists when our best weapon against them is to be the voice of reason and evidence. The Labour Party therefore faces challenges peculiar to its own history, magnified by the contemporary crisis of its global family. I honestly can't see any path forward other than fundamental reconstruction. So we could debate a myriad of detailed policies on social care, infrastructure, inequality, crime, education, health, North versus South, coastal versus cosmopolitan, new campaign techniques, social media, and all of them matter. But there are three overarching strategic challenges within which the answers to all of these must be found. Now, for brevity, I'm going to summarize them, though, frankly, each one of them is worth a book. And none of them work on their own. They have to be done together. First, we must build a new progressive coalition to put Labour values into practice. We must correct the defect from our birth, which separated the liberal reforming traditions of Lloyd George, Beveridge, and Keynes from the Labour ones of Hardy, Attlee, Bevan, and Bevan.
So listen to what he wants to do. He wants to create a fusion between essentially what is the Lib Dems and the old left. He wants to fuse modern liberalism with, you know, the more kind of socialist left. Why is Blair asking for that fusion? I guarantee you, he's asking for that fusion because he would have looked at the last election results and spotted in many, many seats that if the Lib Dems hadn't run and the Lib Dem votes and the Labour votes would have been combined, that could have given a victory to the left because the total votes were more than the Tory votes. And this is something obviously that a lot of people would have spotted. So he is seeing that as a kind of, you know, the Lib Dems are splitting the left vote at the moment, and this is his way of basically saying, well, this is where we need to be. We either need to buddy up with the Lib Dems, or we need to steal their turf to get all those voters back over. But of course, the typical Lib Dem voter is not going to touch a party led by Corbyn or a Corbynista. That's his basic message here.
These traditions became separated by ideas around class, industrial organization, the role of the state, and individual liberty, all of which ideas are time-bound. But they had in common social reform, advancement of opportunity, passionate commitment to fighting poverty and injustice, all of which are timeless.
This is also a point that James Burnham makes in that book that I did the upload, you know, The Suicide of the West. He says that the logic of liberalism and the logic of socialism are identical. Tony Blair spots the same thing. You know, it's just two different movements in the same direction, driving at different speed limits. So let's keep on going.
How this is done, institutionally, that's a matter for debate. But intellectually and philosophically, it is absolutely essential these two traditions are reunited. With one qualification. Those liberal politicians that I mentioned aspired to govern. Today's Lib Dems would have to show the same clarity of purpose.
So there it is. He wants the alliance with the Lib Dems. The Lib Dems can't be scared of entering into coalition government. There's no other way to defeat the Tories on the current map. That's what Blair is saying.
And remember, there are many progressives who presently do not feel at home in either political party or in any political party. Secondly, if Labour becomes simply more moderate and less extreme, of course it will do better, but not much. The problem is that we have defined radical politics by a policy agenda which is hopelessly out of date, with moderate politics being just a milder version of it. We must redefine what radical means. We are living through a technology revolution, which is the 21st century equivalent of the 19th century industrial revolution. It will change everything, and therefore everything must change, including radical reorientation of government itself.
This was always a very strong strand of Blair's kind of rhetoric and worldview. The world's changing. Technology is coming. We need to embrace it. We need to step on the accelerator. That's always been Blair's message. And this is what he's saying here. But we need to, essentially, he's saying, embrace Globo Homo. Don't try to work against it with your old-fashioned socialism, because it's outdated, it's outmoded, it belongs to the distant past. Embrace your corporate future. That's what he's saying here.
This is the context in which we tackle inequality, promote social justice, and redistribute power.
And this goes back to my analysis of the managerial elite. Blair can see that corporations, that what is known as Globo Homo, that the system, the liberal order of the managerial elites, and, you know, previously the EU, but obviously we're out of that now. The combination of the media, the corporations, and the state can all work together in this kind of nice synergy that he, if you remember, was part of creating back in the late 90s and the early 2000s. So this is what he's saying. He's saying, listen, the corporations are on your side, lefty. So tone it down with the socialist stuff. Get back on board. Get back with the program. You're not seeing the wood for the trees. This is what he's saying.
And the context for urgent action on climate.
Note that the climate change is part of the same agenda. Interesting, isn't it?
One big change. Green politics is no longer a single issue. It's an approach that is new to the whole of politics. But it needs a re-engineering of society and the economy, which can't be left to the politics of street protest.
All of society and all of the economy need to be re-engineered. Engineered. because of climate change. He said it there, which is just about the most radical thing it's possible to say. And he's just said it. Let's see where he goes.
What's more, the old labour market isn't coming back. Additional solutions won't cure regional disparity, low productivity, stagnant wages amongst the section of the population, the communities and the people left behind. We need of the modern economy. But an old-fashioned left advocating old ways in a new world won't be trusted to do it. Which brings me to the third point. The right ideas in politics never work without the right mentality. By mentality, I mean the mentality of government. The Labour Party is not an NGO and not a pressure group. Its aim is not to trend on Twitter or to have celebrities, temporarily, by the way, fawn over it, or to glory in a bubble of adulation pricked by the sharp point of the first tough decision. Our task is to win power.
I mean, this just pure like Robin McKell's. It's like you won't get anywhere unless you have power. Address, you know, this is you need to get into the institutions. It needs to be your hands on the lever.
To get our hands stuck into the muddy mangle of governing, where out of it can be pulled the prize of progress, measured not in fine words spoken at a distance, but in real grounded changes in the well-being of the people, some of which they may thank us for, and many of which they will never even know were down to our struggle.
I mean, we're thanking you so much at the moment, Tony. We're thanking you so much for all of the reforms and the changes you wrought in this country. We really love it, don't we? Let's carry on.
To place self-discipline over self-indulgence. Our mission is to take causes and make them practical, to say yes to ambition and no to overambition or the wrong ways of realizing it, to go to where the people are and show them together we can do better.
Listen to the way he framed that. To go to where the people are, not to reflect what the people want, but to show the people there's a better way of doing this. You see, this is the trick. You see, he's not saying change your policies to reflect what people want. He's saying try to like speak the same language of the people and then bring them on board, bring them on side, so that they too will be up for your progressive revolution.
Our actions in their reality to align their values with ours.
Align their values with ours.
So, those are the three things. They're profound changes to philosophy, policy, and practice. That is the scale of the remaking. What is going to make the next 120 years different from the first? And that is the big challenge, and a mountain bigger, frankly, than who's the next leader of the Labour Party. So I have taken stock. The conclusion, after yet another defeat, 120 years from our birth, is not a return to anything. 2020 isn't 1997 or even 2007, and 2030, by the way, will be a revolution different from 2020. It is always about the future. But it's precisely because of that, because whilst pointing forwards, for too long we have been travelling backwards, nothing less than a born-again, head-to-toe renewal will do for Labour and for progressive politics.
See, it's interesting, isn't it? This is the mirror image of what I was saying in the previous stream with Dangerfield, talking about how you kind of need new forms. You need like a new way, not a kind of going back or a. You need, and he's just saying the same thing, but from the opposite point of view. This is where things get interesting now. It's the questions. Q&A time.
do you think the Labour Party seems to hate being in power so much? Is there actually a sort of sense of the anti-establishment that people feel it's almost corrupting or somehow dirty to be in government?
I think it's that the Labour Party does want to be in power, but it's a cause. You know, it's a cause that's about things like social justice and alleviation of poverty and helping those who can't help themselves. Whereas the Tory party's always been, its mission is to govern. You know, the Tory party, that's what they do. And unfortunately for us, they've done it quite successfully in terms of...
100% correct, by the way. The Tory party is not a cause. It doesn't have any principles. It doesn't have any guiding moral philosophy. It literally just wants to govern. I mean, the Tory party truly are the pure Machiavellian party in our power structures. Blair recognizes this. And he's saying, like, literally, if the Labour Party want to have any chance of fighting the Tories, they need to get their hands dirty with this way of thinking as well.
It's a political competition over 200 years. But for us, it's always a cause. And therefore, what happens is, because politics in government is always about difficult decisions, messy compromises, step-by-step progress. You know, people on the progressive side and the Labour side of politics often feel that all of those things somehow undercut your principles. But of course, the obvious truth is, without being in power, your principles are pretty meaningless.
Do you think Labour really wants to win now?
I think it does really want to win. The question is, does it want to win enough so that it's prepared, one, to understand why it lost, and B, to make the changes necessary not to lose again.
So the left would say New Labour was the aberration, and now it's a return to true Labour values. Why is that not right?
I think one of the problems with Labour is that it constantly misreads its own history. And one of the great things about Glenn's pamphlet today is that it explains Labour history. I mean, Labour has only ever won as a centre-left party. Only ever. And so there's a great myth about the Attlee government that, you know, Clem Attlee and the people with him were sort of socialist revolutionaries. Clem had been the deputy prime minister to Churchill in the war years. The 1945 Labour government, in a sense, continued that. I mean, whenever you talk to people from abroad about 1945, the thing they say is, you guys are pretty ungrateful. I mean, Churchill won the war and then you kick him out with the landslide for the Labour Party. And you have to explain to them, yeah, that Churchill was fighting the war, Clement Attlee was looking after the domestic agenda, and basically there was a whole coming together. You know, the Education Act 1944, the National Health Service actually grew out of a whole lot of things that were already happening and being discussed and debated.
100% true, by the way. Nothing Blair has said so far could in any way be construed as untrue. This is an accurate analysis of the situation as it was on the ground. The Clement Attlee government wasn't the radical, extreme kind of left-wing Marxist or anything like that, especially in their social views. They were socially conservative, as somebody like Lord Keynes would tell you.
And Clement Attlee, Ernie Bevin, Herbert Morrison, you know, these people were very much on the moderate side of politics. Then you go to Harold Wilson and you look at the 64 to 70 government. Who were the big players? Harold Wilson, George Brown, Dennis Healey, Roy Jenkins, you know, it's Jim Callaghan. I mean, they weren't exactly trots, you know. So it's the thing with the Labour Party is it has to understand its own history. It's never won when it's been parked in on the far left, never.
So what is it about that, the left wing?
This is absolutely a fundamental thing. The far left, as far as I know, has never won over a populist, ever. It's won over elites. I don't know, even in like communist revolutions and things, I don't think they ever won over the populace.
Politics that puts voters off.
What is it that puts voters off? Well, nowadays, it's an attachment to a form of power that people in today's world. It's foreign policy, as I say, that's kind of anti-Western. I think there's a real risk that progressive politics goes down a, this cul-de-sac of kind of identity politics. You know, it's people don't like the sectarianism. Also, you know, I remember when I first became Labour leader, someone getting up in a meeting and saying to me in a very accusatory voice, right, I've been listening to you, and I've worked out what you're trying to do. You're trying to get people who voted Tory to vote Labour. And this was a... I said, well, yeah, I am trying to do that. And they were obviously disgusted by this. But, you know, just take Labour's current predicament. Someone has decided after a lifetime of voting Labour to vote for the Tories and Boris Johnson. You've got to get inside their head. Not your head, their head.
So what do you think when...
I mean, it's so obvious when he puts it like that. He's absolutely right. But listen to what he wants to do with this. I mean, look, okay, this is one thing, get inside their head. What does he want to do with the power? Let's see where this goes.
Labour MPs say they'd never be friends with the Tory, you know, and denounce even some moderate Labour MPs as Tories.
Yeah, well, you're just basically saying to the people who you need to win, we don't like you.
Okay.
Which is not a great start to a political conversation, to be absolutely frank. I mean, but it's, you see, the trouble is, it's all about, I mean, look, I understand.
You see, I genuinely laugh then, because say what you want about him, he is charismatic. This is genuine charisma here. And you're thinking, yeah, he's right. He's right. He's been right about this. We're 20 minutes in here, and he said nothing that most people would disagree with here. You know, he's basically been correct. And he's cracking jokes, and you're starting to think like, oh yeah, I can see why now this guy won so many elections, because, you know, he's kind of bringing people with him. This is a very good persuasion technique, as Scott Adams would say. Let's keep on going.
When you're running for the leadership, and someone said this to me, a Labour Party member the other day, they said, look, you can't be too purist about this. You know, when you were running for the leader, you didn't throw clause 4 in there right up front in the faces of the party members. And that's true. And so I'm cut a lot of slack for the people fighting a leadership election now. You know, you're in front of your activists. I understand that. But I would say...
So he's saying, hide your true event, hide your true intentions from the activists. Get them on board. And then once you're in power, you know, reveal your true agenda. That's basically what he's saying.
When I was fighting for the Labour leadership, yes, it's true, I was careful, but no one was in any doubt the Labour Party was going to change if I got elected. So I think the thing is, you've got to really go to where people are. And, you know, you've got to realise that any of us in the Labour Party are probably to the left of where most of the British public are.
I mean, he's just said it right there. Anybody in the Labour Party is to the left of where the British public are. So he's saying you need to start from a point of where they are. He's not saying change your views to reflect, you know, change your policies and your views to reflect to where the people are. He's saying start the conversation from where they are, and then basically somehow like win them on board or get them on board somehow, and then we can do what we really want.
So your conversation has got to be in the real world with people who are, you know, living their lives and who've decided to reject you. And I think the important thing for Labour to understand about this last election is that the country, it didn't just decide not to elect us. It really shut the door in our face.
Do you think any of the candidates get that? Who do you think would be the best leader?
I don't want to damage anyone by supporting them, but...
See, he understands how unpopular he is. We're on the left, he understands how unpopular he is in the country. He understands he's a toxic brand at this point. He's aware of the optics. But has he named me one thing that he said in 20 minutes so far that isn't absolutely true from the Labour Party's point of view?
So I've made up my mind. I'm not going to give an opinion on which candidate. Look, I think basically there is an understanding in the Labour Party of this. You know, I think whatever happens is going to be a significant improvement. My the purpose in saying what I'm saying today, which, you know, will irritate some people in the Labour Party and in the leadership, I'm sure, is just to say, you've always got to watch how politics moves on. You see, at the last election, if we'd suddenly got rid of Jeremy Corbyn and put in someone more moderate, I think we'd have done a lot better at this last election. I think the country would have said, well, you're getting it, okay, we're going to give you... Five years' time is not enough just to be moderate, because the Tories will have 5 years of government. They're going to try and establish a real political hegemony. And our voters, once they voted Tory for the first time, you know, that first time was tough for them. Second time might be easier for them. You've got to watch that. So that's why when I'm...
The taboo is broken. The mental barriers are broken. He understands it.
What I'm saying is, when you really look objectively at our position, fundamental reconstruction is what you need. Now, I don't think you can tell whether any of the leadership people or the people likely to win are going to do that or not right now. But I'm just saying, when you look, if you take a hard, long look at the Labour Party today, you'd have to say its problem is serious and fundamental. And if you can't get that far, your risk is that people at the next election say, well, we told you what to do and you just didn't do it. So this time, we're actually finding it easy to vote Tory.
So you think those votes that Boris Johnson says are just low could be given in places like Sedgefield? I mean, how did you feel when you saw Sedgefield?
Now, let me just mention something. Do not think for a second that every single person in the Labour Party, whether it's Long Bailey or Keir Starmer or Lisa Nandy, didn't watch and absorb every single word of this speech, because they are. All of the Labour High Command are watching this speech. What he's saying is going in. This is not a speech. This is not an event for Joe Public to watch. This is not an event for most Labour voters and activists to watch. This is an event for elites by elites. Blair is speaking directly to the elites here. Very interesting to watch this kind of open thinking. I'm actually surprised that King's left this up, to be honest, because it really is something.
Well, it's terrible. I mean, I felt terrible, first of all, for my successor, Phil Wilson, who's a great guy, really lovely person, and did a good job. But most of all, I feel angry when the Labour Party refuses to do what is necessary, because you've got a Tory government now that basically doesn't... It's not going to feel any restraint from having a successful opposition. Yeah, the Tories are not going to be sitting there wondering, oh dear, what about the Labour Party? Not yet.
Now, this is a really important point for us, because he's right. Boris and co. aren't worried about Labour right now. They'll be worried. They'll start looking, actually, to the pressure coming from their right. And it needs to be there. This is what I keep on saying. You've got to understand the play. It needs to be there. We need to be there, providing pressure on the economic right, on the cultural right, both wings constantly griping Tories, constantly letting them know that people don't want some leftwards drift. Very important.
Yeah, at any rate. So when you don't have a viable opposition that's competitive, you also permit the government to do whatever it wants to do. So, and in our case, there'll be things that are going to be very difficult for the country, I think.
Go on, Priti Patel. Smash the civil service.
Will those votes come back to Labour? Yeah, of course they can come back to Labour. But we have to show we've listened.
And what do you think was more to blame? Jeremy Corbyn, Brexit, or the manifesto?
Well, let's say the three in combination were unusually difficult. I think it was the whole thing. You see, with Brexit... So I have this debate a lot of people, and some very reasonable people who will make a very reasonable point to people like me, and they'll say, look, we should have just gone for a soft Brexit compromise. We might have got that through Parliament, and, you know, that would have been a way out of Brexit. Now, I personally don't think that is correct, but I think it's a very serious argument. So on the Brexit side of things, I'm willing to really listen to what people are saying about.
Do you see what you did there? Just like, let's park that to one side. Let's put a box around it I hear what you're saying. I concede your point. What I want to do in this, what I want to do today is basically to hammer the far left and to bring the Labour Party back to being electable. So let's just forget about Brexit for the time. That's an old battle. Let's not get bogged down in that. This is a terrific framing. He's put a box around it. He said, no, we're not going to discuss that today. We're going to keep focused on what I want to talk about, which is this stuff, the stuff that matters.
My point is this, and I think in a curious way, Boris Johnson and I have the same position.
Someone should just take that clip. In a curious way, Boris Johnson and I have the same position. Take that clip, meme it, make it go viral. That would be tremendous because it would Boris does not want to be perceived as having the same position as Tony Blair.
Which is, I don't think you can ever unite the country over Brexit. You can unite them after Brexit. So if we'd stopped Brexit, which I think we could have done, we'd had serious opposition. I would have said you immediately then have to deal with all the problems that gave rise to Brexit that people were voting. So you'd have had to have taken a whole series of measures to make sure you were pulling those people back towards you, having, in a sense, alienated them by not doing Brexit. And I think what Boris Johnson is doing is he's wrapping it around the other way. He's saying we're going to do Brexit, but now we're going to reach out to all these northern places and we're going to bring those Brexit people, you know, we're going to try and keep them with us. Now,
see, he's not thick. He knew that it would have been a really unpopular thing to stop Brexit. But he's like, we could have done it. We could have done it using the tools, you know, playing the board that they had, using the rotten parliament, using John Bercow, all of those tactics that Alistair Campbell and Mandelson were advocating for during all of that stuff. But he knows that game is lost. Let's keep on going.
So I think if the Labour Party had taken a strong position on Brexit and said to the country, look, we're going to give the government the chance to negotiate an agreement. If they come up with a bad agreement, we're going to say that it should be put back to the people. I think if they'd said that right from the very beginning, I think we would have got through it. Yes, we'd have lost some people, but we'd have kept others. But to be in the situation where you, I mean, it was a bizarre policy, right? We were going to negotiate this agreement with Europe, and then we were going to have a referendum on it where we couldn't actually say either to the Europeans or indeed to the country which way we'd vote. I don't think that wouldn't have been an easy negotiation.
And do you think now Labour should be campaigning to rejoin?
No. Okay. You just can't, I'm afraid. Look, long term, who knows? But, and the Tories will own Brexit, whatever happens. But you've got to give it a chance to be done. I think government will face. I think it is. It's not clear to me the degree to which this is all sabre rattling and.
So you see, he gets it. That battle's lost. Let's move on. He doesn't want to be talking about this. He wants to be talking about he wants to park this issue because he understands that one was a loss for them.
You know, people are just kind of putting themselves out there to in the pre-negotiation. If the government really wants to diverge significantly from European regulation, though, they'll have a very tough negotiation. And I only hope they are correcting the biggest mistake of the Theresa May negotiation. The biggest mistake was making political statements without technical analysis. I mean, Brexit is at one level a very technical thing. Trade agreements are technical. And by the way, think about trade agreements, as anyone who's got experience of government knows, is everyone, it's a bit like reform. Everyone's in favor of trade agreements. In principle, everyone is in favor. It's just when you get to the detail, it's bloody difficult. So I think if the government isn't doing the technical work, it's going to be a problem. But I've got to assume that they will. And so I can't tell what's going to happen with it. But there's no point in the Labour Party should just be critiquing what the government's doing from a sensible position. But there's no point in it. The country does not want, in the short term at any rate, to re-debate Brexit.
Do you think Rebecca Bailey is right that Jeremy Corbyn should be given 10 out of 10?
Supposing you just guess the answer to that right from the beginning. Okay.
Just explain why you might think she's wrong.
Well, they're not. You know, for the British people, they have never voted for that type of far left politics. And for the people in constituencies like mine, patriotism is like number one thing, right? Or it's not necessarily number one, that's not the right way of putting it. It's preconditional, right? You may decide your vote on the basis of the health service, but if you've got any doubts about patriotism, and that's just forget it.
Look at the way he thinks about patriotism. He's not saying you should be patriotic. He's saying you need to present yourselves to these areas of the country as being a patriot. And of course, we know that Blair did this through his war efforts, through his, you know, invoking Churchill, you know, for his anti-jihadi war and all, you know, the war on terror, the war in Iraq, all of these sorts of things. If you remember, that was all draped in the Union Jack. It came draped in the idea of being a patriot. So this isn't a genuine patriotism. This is a purely instrumental patriotism used basically to hoodwink voters in some of these working class areas that he's talking about. And you can see that in the way that he's talking about it.
I'm afraid people just had a lot of doubts.
So the manifesto, the Corbyn supporters would say the policies are very popular, you know, people like them, they polled well.
Yeah.
What went wrong there?
Well, to be honest, they really liked it if we lost. Mm. I've never quite got this one, actually, which is they really liked our policies. They really wanted them. They really hated the Tory policies. And I don't know, they just voted Tory. They did not like the policies. Individual policies. See, there's a thing about individual policies and the polling. It's why I always used to say to people, and I learned this in the 1980s and 90s, which is the fallacy of polling individual policies and thinking you're learning something. Because when you're polling an individual policy, first of all, you're separating it from the whole. And in the end, it's the whole thing that people vote on. So you can take individual policies, and each one of them might be popular, but you put them all together and it's not popular. But secondly, when you poll individual policies, it's why I call the difference between a 3-second conversation, a 30-second conversation, and a 3-minute conversation. Right, so railway renationalization, 3-second conversation, it should be in public ownership. 30-second conversation, you're going to spend a lot of time on renationalizing the railways, and it could cost quite a lot of money, and you've got all the things to do with pension funds. 30-second conversation, maybe 3-minute conversation. Here are the big challenges of transport going forward. You're going to have driverless vehicles, electric cars. You're going to have to reimagine the entire infrastructure of the country. And you guys are going to be spending all your time on railway renationalization. 3-minute conversation. I think that's a very good idea, actually. You poll individual policies. It doesn't, you go back to the 1980s, by the way.
This is some genuine political wisdom from Tony Blair. Genuine insight on how polls work, how people conceive of policies, how people reconstitute them when they put them all together. And if you remember, when I was going through the Labour manifesto, I highlighted specific policies, but then it was like putting them all together. Do you remember? I got to page 13, I was like, there's the economy gone. Yeah, I wonder how many other people did that. So he's absolutely correct that individual things might be popular, but you put them all together and you think, well, you can't do it all. The absolutely crucial insights from Blair here. If you're on the nationalist side of things and you ever run, these are some genuine sorts of things that you'd have to think about, right? Genuine sorts of things that you'd have to think about. This is superb insight from Blair. Let's keep on going.
By the way, all Labour's policies, apart from unilateral nuclear disarmament, were popular. I remember. This is why I sat and studied this during the 1980s, because I couldn't work it out at first. I was reading these polls saying privatization was really unpopular, trade union law was really unpopular, tax cuts at the top end were really unpopular, so how come Margaret Thatcher kept winning by a landslide? I spent a lot of time puzzling this, and these are the two conclusions I came to. In the end, it's about the whole thing, and it's a fallacy to think that individual policies can be polled and separated in that way. And so I think most people... Look, they said what they said. I mean, it's clear. And by the way, virtually every single person who's done independent reviews of what happened in the election said the same thing. People thought the manifesto was incredible. And if it's incredible, it's not a good idea. Because, you know, especially if you're living a really tough life and someone promises you the earth, it's just, it's not a credible thing. And so the manifest wasn't, it wasn't popular, and B, it was wrong. I mean, the most important thing is that it was wrong. You know, this is why I made this point about the technology revolution. The challenge for progressive politics today is to recognize the sheer scope and scale and speed of that revolution. It's going to change everything. And it's going to mean, a huge re-engineering. If you want to take...
No. Notice the way that Blair talks here. He always talked about this, even in the late 90s and the early 2000s. He's saying, listen, we're on a steam train. We're on a steam train, and it's coming no matter what. It is inevitable. The future is inevitable. It's going to go like this. It's going to go like this. We might as well recognize it and harness it and be there. This was always the way that he framed things. And it builds up this kind of irresistible picture. Now, we might actually start to question, like, well, are all of these things inevitable? Are all of these things definitely going to happen? Does there need to be a technology revolution? Will there be a technology revolution? You know, all of these things that he's talking about, you might question. But sitting here listening to him, it just sounds like this is going to happen, and we better be there, basically. We better be on board. We better be sitting in the driver's seat of the steam train rather than letting the steam train drive us. This was always Blair's trick, in a way. And it's still, I mean, I still think that there'll probably be people watching this now who may be taken in by this, who may be thinking, yeah, he's got a point. He's got a point. We need to start thinking like Andrew Yang or something, you know?
Green politics, seriously. You're going to have to reimagine the economy. Right? Now, the people who will be trusted to do that...
I mean, you know, all of this is being driven by climate change, this inevitable change that's going to happen that we all need to get on board with. You see, this is where it starts to break down a little bit. But listen to what you, like, if you're sitting in that room, you're thinking, yeah, Tony's making great points here. We need to be in 2040. We need to be there with our electric cars or whatever else he's talking about.
Are people who, one, understand the future, understand what's going to happen, and two, are prepared.
And the future as you envisage it, Tony, the future that you and all of your elite mates envision. That's the bit he's leaving out. But he's making it sound like it's inevitable, though, that there's no choice in this. We have to embrace this. This is how he ended up selling mass immigration to the country, by the way. You know, he always framed it in this way. It's happening no matter what. Like, we don't have a choice in the matter, so we might as well, you know, be there driving the steam train. So let's keep on going.
To help you through it, but in a forward and modern-oriented way. They're never going to trust people who believe in sort of old-style collectivism to help them through that. So that's, you know, if I was back in frontline politics today, the first thing I would do is just get us to rethink policy from first principles. What are the huge changes that are going to happen in our country and in other modern developed countries in the next few years? The left always wins when people think they need a government on their side helping them, right? So how is that government going to be constituted? How are you going to manage to make sure that industry prepares for digitalization, that your healthcare system gets reformed, education system, law and order, as a result of technological change? How is that going to happen? Who are the types of people you need to form alliances with in order to get those answers right? And that's...
Let's get Google and Twitter and Facebook all on board. That's what he's saying. You got to work with the big mega corporations, people. You're thinking in the wrong way, leftists. You need to embrace the globo homo. There's no other way. There is no other way. That's what he's saying.
You know, that's where the future's going to be decided. So this is... The problem with the manifesto is that it wasn't popular, but it also just wasn't, you know, so you have a debate about the health service in this country today, which the Labour Party should just get way above it. The debate is basically, the Tories say, we're under lots of pressure on health. By the way, this is what they always say. We're under lots of pressure on health, we'll throw some more money at it. Labour says, however much money you spend on the health service, whatever it is, we're going to double it. That's the debate. You could have had that debate in the 1980s, and we just had it in 2019.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true as well.
What we're going to be saying is, is, let's reimagine the health service today with all the changes that are necessary. Now, if we do that, then when we're saying we're going to invest in the healthcare system, people say, yeah, but these guys know that we're going to do this differently. That's why, you know, one of the things that we did do when I was in government, by the time I left office, you know, health service satisfaction was at its highest rating since the health service began.
There he is with the stats again, always with the stats, always backed up by some study, by some, you know, IFS report, by some independent review. I mean, he doesn't mention the fact, like, who's funding all these people. You know, they're all part of his elite circles. They're all, like, on the same board. It creates a credible narrative. If you're sitting there thinking, I'm the sensible centrist who's driven by fact and logic and evidence, you know, this is winning you around.
If you go transgender rights is our big thing, and the right goes immigration controls is our big thing, you're going to lose that war.
I mean, there it is. This is what YouTube has been for the past 3 years. You know, they go with transgender rights as our big thing. The right go with immigration control. Saying that you're not going to win the political battle if it's fought on that terrain. He understands that that culture war is basically fighting on our terrain, and he wants to get off that. He knows that's a hiding to nothing. And this is obviously, I don't know anybody who could really disagree with what he's saying here. But let's keep on going.
You're going to lose that. So you're not going to advance any of the things you want to do. So we don't need to be fighting that culture war. That doesn't mean to say you don't take the right positions on things.
So would you sign?
You know, stay PC, still support transgender rights, but don't lead on it. Don't go into a culture war with the right because they'll smash you. You know, you want to actually avoid these things. Like, conceal the fact that you want the transgender rights. You know, try to get off the immigration subject because, you know, you're weak there. This is like truly Sun Tzu Art of War stuff he's talking about. Let's keep on going.
Sign this pledge, for example, if you
would. No, I wouldn't.
Why not?
Because I think there are all sorts of difficult issues that have to be resolved. There's a proper consultation that's going on, and we should do it in that way. But if you're going out there and you're going to start trying to advocate things, this is what the last point I was making, in a kind of finger-jabbing, sectarian way, you know, you don't sign up to what I'm saying, then I'm going to come and disrupt your meetings and shout at you. You're not
going to
win that battle.
Of course. I mean, what has Sargon of Akkad been saying for 5 years at this point? That is what Tony Blair is saying here. Right? That's a standard 2015 Sargon of Akkad video right there in that past 3 or 4 minutes. He understands that point. Note, he's not saying abandon advocacy for transgender rights, though.
It's going to put a whole lot of people off. So it's... And it's another thing about the left that one of the other problems of that manifesto, I actually read it, by the way, I don't know how many people did, but I read it. It's 97 pages, I think it was. And the more you read it, the less convinced you became.
Yeah,
it was
true.
An incredible document. Because on every page, you could see someone had come and knocked on the door and said, hey, here's a 10-point plan on this, and I want £1 billion. Yeah, okay. Let's put that in there. And then the next page, another 10-point plan, another billion.
Yeah, it literally was like that. Every single page was a new revolution, I remember.
They want to know that if they're, and they want to know this far more than they do about the Tory party, because as I say, they understand the Tory party's purpose is to govern the Labour party's accords. So what they want to know about a Labour party leader is...
Incidentally, I think that the problem that we have on the right is exactly what you said. The Labour Party is a cause. The Tory Party is to govern. Where's the right-wing cause? There should be a right-wing cause pushing, whether it's a party or a pressure group or something. There needs to be a cause on the right. Otherwise, they set the centre of gravity, even if they're out of power, as we're seeing now.
Is it the end? He or she is in charge. Right, they're in charge. And yes, pressure groups will be listened to. Yes, trade unions will be listened to. But they're in charge. Because otherwise what they fear is precisely what that manifesto ended up with. So everybody who shouts or disrupts or throws something, you know, yeah, okay, we'll give it to you as well. I mean,
people so being in charge means saying no.
Yeah, look, test. Any politician can say yes, it's pretty easy. It's when you say no, particularly to your own people. But I may be wrong with this, but I think with progressive politics particularly, the public wants to know that whoever is the leader, that person is prepared to say no to their own folk. Because they know it's a cause, and therefore because they always worry that you're going to be, you know, playing to your activist base. You know, this I think is going to become, by the way, a huge problem for the Democrats in the US, but it's another sad story.
You see, he knows. He absolutely understands.
What do you think should happen there? Are you worried that they're going to make the same mistake with Sanders that Labour made with Corbyn?
Well, I mean, it's up, as I always say when I'm in America, someone asks me who I back, so I've got enough problems with my own politics without getting into yours, but... But I would take a pretty careful look at the Labour Party if I was a Democrat. Mm. Let's put it like that.
And what about Bloomberg? Do you think he's the answer?
No, I'm not going to get into that.
I suppose that...
You see, do not go down that route. I'm not going to talk about it. Let's move on. Come on.
The big question is whether, you know, you talk about the centre being the solution, but actually the Lib Dems did terribly at the election. Do you think actually perhaps the centre isn't the answer anymore? Perhaps people are looking for clear, more clarity and more radical answers.
Well, you can be clear and radical still in the centre. Look, I think the problem for the Lib Dems was that, you know, to be very honest about it, for a few months it looked as if they were going to become the real deal, and then they just became Lib Dems again.
And why was that?
I don't know why they did that, but I mean... They really did. It was just tragic to watch.
What do you mean by that? You mean they...
You know what I mean, really. You know what I mean.
Yeah,
that's the thing. It's, look, I don't think the centre, in the sense of a strong centre, has been on offer. I think if it was on offer, it would do really well. I think, in any
way. I mean, he's obliquely referring to the fact the Lib Dems also went down the... this kind of finger jab. If you remember Jo Swinson, she was also 100% up for the identity politics as well, I suppose, is what he's obliquely referring to.
And, you know, I would suggest it's about time to try it again.
So does that mean a new party?
No, it doesn't mean a new party, but I think, and I said in the speech, I don't know institutionally what happens. I think the most important thing is to debate the scale of the challenge and the principles that should govern it, and then I think you've got to see, but I think anything could happen in British politics. Because I think, you know, the risk for the Labour Party, let's be clear, is that it, you know, the Tories will make, governments make mistakes, they get into trouble, there are scandals, there's this, there's that. You know, you could find a situation where the Labour Party thinks it's doing well because the Tories start to go down in the polls, you know, the old by-election, the sort of local council results. You know, late 85, early 86, Margaret Thatcher and the Tories were in terrible trouble. You know, if I ever want to reconnect with a certain humility about my own predictive capacity, I actually used to keep a political diary at that time, and my entry for January 1986 was, you know, we're going to win the next election. We actually lost by a landslide. So my worry for the Labour Party is that it kind of looks as if we're doing better, but we haven't made the fundamental changes. And then what you find is that, you know, when you then get into the election, what happens in government is that people basically say, most of the time, I'm going to assess the government against the perfect government. In between election times, it's, do I like this government, as opposed to the government in my dreams, which is the government that gets everything right and no difficult decisions and blah, blah, okay. But then you get back into the election again, and then they say, no, actually, I understand it's not perfect, it's the other government. So it's this government versus that government. And then, of course, everything, suddenly the thing evens up again. So if the public has fundamentally rejected us now, and we don't fundamentally change, we're going to kid ourselves 2 years in that we're doing better than we're really doing, because they're not really thinking about us as a government. And then you get into the election and suddenly, you know, you're back to where we were in 87.
So when you talk about a realignment, do you mean a formal alliance with the Lib Dems? Bringing the, as you discussed,
Don't know at this stage. It could go in a number of different directions. But I do know you've got to deal with this defect that's been with us for a long time, because the 120 years is an important thing. It's not in 2019 we did badly. In 120 years, and let's take it 125, maybe 130, if you've been in power for less than a quarter of your existence, I mean, you've got to say that it's not just a temporary problem. Now, I think what's happened is, I mean, basically...
You see, it's interesting, isn't it? Because from our point of view, we feel like they have been in power for all that time. But like you're saying, like formally they haven't. They've only been in power for 25% of the time, which means all the rest of the rubbish was done by the Tories, which should be a wake-up call for right-wingers, hopefully, as well. But let's see where he goes. I might wrap this up in a minute. I don't know if I'll go all the way through. This cigar's almost got a very nice cigar, very sweet cigar, the Paul Laguna. So another 10 minutes of this, and then I'll have a look at the super chats and we'll get out of here.
Liberal and Labour Wings. Now, we did it in different parties, but myself and Paddy Ashton were kind of in a, you know, in a kind of informal alliance together. And that meant that we broadened our appeal, and that's why we won the three elections. But what then happened was we then retreated from that by stages, and then under the Corbyn leadership, we really retreated into a narrow part of Labour. I mean, not even a big part of Labour. So you've got to throw that whole thing open again. And you've got to recognize, I think, the importance of this, the environment and green politics. As I say, I mean, I haven't had time to kind of develop this argument, but I do think the biggest change that's happened since I left office is that this understanding of the environmental threat and how to deal with it is now, I think, fundamental, not just as a single issue, but as a whole politics.
So 120 years on, how much danger is the Labour Party in? Do you think this is a sort of make or break moment, and that it could die if they choose the wrong leader?
Well, it's a make or break moment for sure. Yeah. And my point is, we should use the occasion, because the one thing you do get in opposition is leisure time. You get a lot of that. So you might as well think. I mean, that's what I spent. I mean, I spent all the years from 83 and 94 thinking. You know, a lot of the time was just thinking. So if you think about it, you've got a long-term problem and you've got an immediate problem. And you've got to think your way through both of those things. And you've got to get big philosophical and intellectual structures right around the answers to those questions. And if you do, you could win the next election. But if you don't, then your risk is that you end up, you know, too strong to disappear, but too weak to win.
Right. Okay, I'm going to open up to questions now. John, I'm going to take three, and you can answer.
I'm John McTernan, I'm a recovering political advisor. One of the challenges that you have, you didn't touch on, is we're an aging society, and that's There's going to be big demands on social care, dementia care, when people live to 100. There's a proximate political issue now, which is the government is seeking to restrain migration in ways which will maybe hit the health sector, the social care sector. What are both the big picture challenges for progressive politics on social care, and how would you handle the politics of constraining migration and its impact on the care sector?
Note that the immigration issue was literally Blair's fault. He sidestepped that, but he did recognise that it's unpopular, didn't he?
And then there's two questions over there.
Thanks, Dr. Paul Sagar, lecturer in the Department of Political Economy. I voted for Ed Miliband in 2010, and I bitterly regret having done so. And I'm wondering to what extent you think the pattern you described may in fact have been much closer to being broken, namely if his brother David had won instead.
And then there was one question there. Yeah.
Hi, Rania, Chair of Labour Students. Just in terms of the sectarianism that you spoke about, do you think that can be solved or dealt with within a culture and a society where we have very fast news and social media? How do we work with both of those factors and still tackle sectarianism?
Yeah. Okay. This is three very good questions. I mean, So I think social care is probably the most difficult policy question, because the impact and the expense of it is going to get greater, and there is an urgent need to reintegrate that with the rest of healthcare. And I think, you know, for some of these things, by the way, you should just get the very best people to come together and see if you can work out the right way through it. Although I also think technology's got the potential to change that in a huge way as well. And you're absolutely right that we will need a migrant population to help with this. So you have, in a sense, this clash between an older population, probably that's often very hesitant around immigration, with this urgent need for migration.
You see, he still can't think his way out of this, can he? He still thinks, aging population, the answer is more migration. This is inbuilt, and I would say this is probably the weakest part of Blair's thinking so far. He cannot think of a different way of doing things.
And I think the biggest problem with what the government's announced just in the last couple of days will be, you know, the assumption that there are all these British people who, you know, are desperate to get into these jobs and just haven't found their way there. Now, I think you can deal with the migration problem, but only if you're clear that you want controlled immigration. And this is a very difficult thing from the left. We published a pamphlet recently from my institute in which we said we needed, you know, we need to make sure people integrated. And we suggested a biometric identity card so you know exactly who has the right to be here, who has the right not to be here. And people forget the 2005 election, the Tories wanted to fight with on immigration. We had to answer their positions on it. If you show that you have sensitivity towards people's anxieties about immigration, you can then make the case for immigration.
I mean, listen to the sheer cunning of this. He's saying, listen, I hear you, and we're going to put some controls in, but actually we still need loads of people to come here. But we've listened to you. So, you know, it's almost like just a kind of a steam valve. You know, he's still not really addressing the issue. And this is what they did back in 2005 as well, of course. But it's just enough. It's just enough maybe to get your mother or your father to think, oh, yeah, okay, fair enough. He's listening to me. They're putting some controls in.
But if you're simply saying, well, we're not, you know, even to engage in that debate is either racist or you're, you know, we were accused as an institute of, you know, blaming immigrants for their problems, you're just going to lose that battle altogether. So, I mean, that's a classic example of whether you want to win or you don't want to win.
You've got to win by saying, I hear you. I really see that you don't like all this, so we'll put some controls in. But also, we need like loads of migrant workers anyway, so we're going to bring them anyway. But we've heard you. This is the classic Blair trick. This is what you're saying. Like, you know, yeah, we'll still have all the immigration, but you've got to appear as though you care about it. Now think about that, because it's exactly what Boris Johnson is doing right now, by the way.
You know, if there is real anxiety, you have to deal with the reasonable anxieties in order to be able to make the case for migration. And then you can make the case as to why you're going to need this migration in order to deal with some of the problems we have.
You're still going to get loads of immigrants, bigots, but we're not going to call you bigots. We're going to say, oh, I hear you. I hear you. You're still going to get hundreds and thousands of immigrants, but at least I'm listening. This is basically his proposition.
I think it's the only way of doing it. In 2010, yeah, I think there are going to be, or maybe there already are, PhD theses written about the significance of the 2010 Labour Party result. I mean, I have to say, by the way, I go on perfectly well with Ed and like him as a person, but I think it was a very significant moment, I'm afraid, for the Labour Party. That's all I want to say on that. Sectarianism, yeah. I think social media is a revolutionary phenomenon, by the way. It just changes everything, and it's changed politics. And it's a very sensible question, which is to say, it's all very well to say you don't want sectarianism, but actually social media kind of works through that. And what I would say is, it does, but you've got to put some faith in the people not necessarily liking it, even though it's a big part of their lives. So I always say to people, one of the first things you learn in politics is that those who shout loudest don't necessarily deserve to be heard most. It's a very important lesson. And social media is, it's shouty stuff, right? I think we would do better if we're the calm voice of reason. For us, not...
The calm voice of reason. We're still going to enact transgender rights. We're still going to bring in the mass immigration. But we're still the calm voice of reason. This is the trick.
Not necessarily the right wing, by the way, because they operate in a different way, particularly today. But that's what I think. But I agree, it's difficult. But you can't, you know, you've got to reckon with the fact that most people are pretty normal, I think. I mean, social media has taught you that there's a lot more people who aren't out there than you ever thought before. I mean, it's true. Because, you know, sometimes you read the social media stuff, you think, oh, my God, I mean, really? You know, but I don't think the majority of people think like that. And I also think, again, they quite like leaders who stand up against it.
Do you think the party needs to expel more hardliners, momentum, things like that?
I don't think they just need to defeat them. I mean, these people, look, the thing that happened in the Labour Party, because those of us, many people here are too young to remember this, but those of us who fought these battles in the late 70s, early 80s, what basically happened was that there was a whole kind of, and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell came in on the wave of this, which was to take the Labour Party in a far left position, and Tony Benn was at the time the you know, he was a brilliant politician in many, many ways, was the great architect. So that was a sort of all-out assault on the sort of citadel of Labour politics. And in the end, because by a fraction, Dennis Healey beat Tony Benn for the deputy leadership, it was repulsed. And people forget this. I mean, I first came across Michael Foote when he was the leader of the Labour Party, and I was a young lawyer, acting for the Labour Party and for Michael Foote in the expulsion of militants. Right, so Michael Foote, okay, was on the left, but he wasn't on the far left, right? And then what happened was basically, after that, under Neil Kinnock, then under John Smith, then under me, you know, the door was pretty much locked and bolted to the far left, right? And what happened from 2015 onwards is the door was open with a welcome mat. So all of these people have poured in. Now, I'm not suggesting you're going to expel them all, but you're going to have to, in the end, they're going to have to realize they're not going to, govern the Labour Party anymore, because if they do, we just carry on losing. I mean, you should obviously expel people who are anti-Semitic and this type of thing, but, you know, even with anti-Semitism, it's the anti-Semitism arises from a worldview. You don't defeat that worldview. It's going to hang around there. And people may be more disciplined in what they put out on social media, for example, but they're going to be thinking the same things.
I think it's probably time for one more question, Tim.
All right, let's hear it. I hope people have found this interesting.
My name is Tim Bale, and I teach politics at Queen Mary University, and I am also Deputy Director of UK and Changing Europe. But the question isn't about Brexit. It's about the fact that the Labour Party now has over 500,000 members. And I wondered to what extent you thought in the re-engineering of progressive politics that you're talking about, whatever institutional form it takes, whether those members can be converted into an asset rather than what some people think they've become, which is a liability to change in the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Should we just do one? Have we got?
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay. Let's do one
more. Do one more.
Thank you. Kate McKenna.
Bit of power there by Blair saying, listen, let's take another question. That was shit.
And from Sky News. Mr. Blair, there are a number of candidates in this leadership election who have policies designed to make it difficult to intervene in conflicts abroad. Given the current situation in Syria, how do you feel about that?
On the last one, I mean, one of the great advantages of no longer being the leader of the Labour Party or Prime Minister is you can just sometimes say, I'm not getting into that today. And that's one of the ones I'm not getting into today.
He doesn't want to touch foreign policy because he knows that's the area where he's most toxic.
The Labour Party and its membership. So, when we took over the leadership of the Labour Party in 1994, we actually did this huge job of the members. I'm not saying that the members don't generate a huge amount of new gas that they do. But the problem is membership of the Labour Party. Membership of the Labour Party can follow its leadership. And into the Labour Party, come all those people from the party. Here's the honest truth about it. They will divide into two groups. They will divide into one group, basically, the people who want to change. The Labour Party be not just managing, but changing it, but essentially people that, yes, you can convert those into an asset. And then I'm afraid you get the people who actually really are from the sectarian far left. And I'm not sure there's much you can do with them, because they're not an asset, I'm afraid. And the trouble is, and this is the most difficult thing in the leadership, because, you know, having gone through all this process before, and I think today is much more difficult than it was in 1983, much, much more difficult. But having gone through all this process before, the first thing everyone says is, we've all got to unite. And I worked out over time that actually the first thing you've got to do is decide. You can unite after you decide. But if you've got two groups of people who fundamentally disagree, and I think there is a fundamental disagreement with the sectarian hard left and the Labour Party, as it has been traditionally, I think you've got to decide first. Then you can think about how you unite. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, I think the whole concept of membership and parties.
Do you see how his thinking is fundamentally elitist here? He's saying the leader has got to set the tone. He's got to lead from the front. He's got to make the decision. And then you can deal with the fallout afterwards. This is like true. Like I keep on saying Machiavellian, but this is true, like the art of politics here. He is absolutely correct about this. You know,
is going to change as well in the years to come. And we're going to have to build a whole new progressive alliance. I mean, I think this question of what is the new progressive coalition is a really important question to answer. And the truth is that, you know, that part of the membership of the party today that comes from that sectarian part of politics that some of us, you know, remember so well from the late 70s and early 80s. They're always going to pull you to these unrealistic positions. They're always, I mean, how could we go into an election, which we just did, with a whole lot of reselections hanging over MPs? So when you need them to be out on the doorstep engaging with the public, they're fighting trench war battles in their local constituency parties. I don't know how you reconcile that. So yes, there are people in it who are an asset, but one of the things that's going to have to happen when we get new leadership is you're going to have to try and bring new people into the Labour Party. And one final thing just to say, because this is it's always the challenge of progressive politics. You cannot end up being obliged to have one conversation when you're talking to your party and another conversation when you're talking to the public. That is the end, right? And what I always wanted to do with the Labour Party is to get to the point where you're having the same conversation. Because then, by the way, you're pulling into the Labour Party the broader mass of people who might support your positions. But if you end up in a situation where you're getting rounds of applause from your activists and the public's out there thinking, oh my God, what's this? And that's where we've been. That's, by the way, that is absolutely the risk of the Democrats in the US now. And the other thing just to say is progressive politics worldwide right now in the West, I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. You go around the world, no majority traditional left party in power. You go around Europe today, you look at traditional left parties in France, Germany, virtually anywhere actually in Europe, Italy. You know, they're like kind of defunct almost. So the big challenge for progressive politics. This is why I say, you know, for the Labour Party, what I'd like to see once you get the, look, I understand leadership election is going to take whatever course it takes. Once you do that, we need, excuse me, we need a huge debate in which the Labour Party should be reaching out to other progressive parties. They should be engaging with people engaged in progressive politics right around the Western world. And you start to figure it out. And the conclusion I have come to is one thing, and I may be wrong on this, by the way, but it's this is the conclusion I've come to, which is around this technology revolution. Now, I find it a very difficult thing because you have this conversation with people in politics and they will say to you, yeah, no, it's really interesting, all that technology. Now let's talk about politics. And I think it's the biggest thing. It's the biggest opportunity. It's the biggest challenge. It's the biggest route to creating a different type of society and a better one. And it's the biggest obstacle if it is not handled correctly. So that's what I think. And I think that where progressive politics revives itself is positioning itself absolutely in the future, building a broad alliance of people who understand, you know, of course you need a competitive private enterprise and you need mechanisms of social justice, but all of that is being enveloped by this huge change that's happening, like the 19th century industrial revolution, you know, by the way, which it took politics decades to catch up with. And that's where we should center ourselves. But this is the debate we need to have. And if the debate is simply about whether you renationalize rail or you don't, or energy and water, or whether you even abolishing tuition fees, you don't abolish, this is hopeless. If we stay in this position, then the biggest risk for progressive politics is the right wing just carry on winning by default because there's not a viable progressive alternative, and they determine the future. And by the way, they won't determine it well, because in the end, they don't care in the same way that we do about making sure that things work for the broad mass of people. That's just the difference. So I'm
all right, let's leave it there, shall we? All right, so let's have a look to see what people have been saying, shall we, on this. I hope this was interesting for people, just to see how some of the real thinkers on the left. I mean, I think, I don't know if people would agree with me here, I think Tony Blair and the Alistair Campbells and the Peter Mandelsons are a much more dangerous opponent, much more dangerous, much more canny, much more clever, much more genuinely strategic than the Jeremy Corbyns and the Owen Joneses and the Diane Abbotts. They're just lol cows, let's be honest. But these are the people. He is the guy who is going to push forward with the agenda if he ever got his way. Note, if he got his way, it wouldn't be a curb to any of the social justice policies. It wouldn't be a curb to any of the things that we've been talking about. He'd accelerate all of them, but he'd do it in such a way where the power levels are concealed. So there we go. I thought this was thought this might be interesting. So let's have a look at the super chats and then we'll get out of here. So Samuel Marston says, does smoking a cigar outside my uni accommodation make me look cool, or does it make me look like a pretentious Tory? I put my trust in you, AA. Well, the thing is, Samuel Marston, I don't know how 18 and 19 year olds think at this point. So there we go. Maximum, you'd have to ask other people your age if it's cringe, as the cool kids say, or if it's cool. I would say, if you do it with confidence, if you do it unapologetically, if you just like, you know, you're not posing, you're literally just, this is my thing. I smoke big Cuban cigars or whatever, then people will respect it. If you do it self-consciously, then they'll think that you're a pretentious twat, probably. That's how it usually goes with those things. So it's less about what you're doing and more about how you carry yourself. Maximilian Lollius says, good content. This is the standard. P.S. Woods argues like a leftist. I mean, the less said about Keith Woods, the better. I wrote a community post basically rebutting the absolute rubbish he was talking in that video. The main problem is, and this is, I don't think it deserves a response, but what I will say, if any of his crowd are watching this, I'll say I'm angry at Keith Woods, because that stuff I've been talking about, the managerial elites and the way that mass ownership works and the severing between ownership and control, this is a very, very important, you could say it's a red pill or a black pill, or it's just truth. This is absolute, a vital part of knowing what we're up against, a vital diagnosis. It was made by Sam Francis, first of all, speaking at the American Renaissance group. And this fucking twat has come in, got the wrong end of the stick, thought I was arguing from some completely different place. I mean, if you watch his video, it shows he didn't understand the argument. And so what I'd say is that little kids like him need to fuck off when actual men do the proper thinking that is required at this moment. He is an active detriment to his movement. He's an active detriment to the right wing, and he needs to piss off, do some reading, and come back when he learns how to read and when he learns how to analyze arguments. That's the only thing I'll say about Keith Woods. Fucking prick. Christian Verti says, will be re-engineered into the first green empire. Absolutely true. Chris Primer says, interesting, the color purple on his tie near the typical red nor blue makes my noggin jog. Yeah, it's also he would have thought about what color tie he's wearing. This is like the, you know, Blair's always presenting himself. I'm on your side. I'm listening to you. I hear what you're saying about immigration or whatever it is. This is how you always did it. I hear what you're saying about crime. I'll come and meet you halfway. And then he still enacts the radical left wing agenda when he's in power. Just, you know. So, yeah, I thought very interesting. Coney says, Tony Blair, Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson, Satan, the deceiver and the prince of darkness. Absolutely true. Dave said, Tony Blair denied knowing anything about Machiavelli. The caretaker of the Machiavelli residence said he had visited. He is all about power. Absolutely true. He is 100% creature of the new left. You know, he's a Gramscian. He's, you know, all that stuff that Hitchin said is true. And I think this was one of the times where he truly revealed some of his power levels over the course of this hour and, you know, hour speech. Samuel Marston says, cigar was terrible. Ended up smoking some herb. Well, there we go. Mike Hogg say, well, would just like you to say ethno-nationalism should be okay for the UK. And George says, do you think Blair works for someone, or does he believe his garbage? It's hard to know, but he is absolutely the he is working in the interests of and for what I'm calling the managerial elite. He is the absolute embodiment of that particular way of seeing the world. Everything he did when he was in power increased the power of managerial elites. Everything he said just now furthered their agenda. But this is the thing that we're really up against. It's him. It's not the Jeremy Corbyns. So they're just, like you said, they're a bunch of far left fantasists, most of them. But yet, if he ever got into power, and this is something to watch for Boris Johnson, because I actually think that Boris Johnson is just the kind of, like a right wing mirror of Blair. You know, so if you imagine Boris Johnson saying all this stuff, I imagine that he would have been watching that speech and just kind of copying, taking notes. You know, there we go. So anyway, hopefully people found this. The Invidious Envy says, with Sue Yaw shouting at the tea fallout, I've just found out I have my own page and article section on Know Your Mean. I've made it on normie internet. Well, Invidious Envy, I will have a look at, send me the link to the Know Your Meme stuff in Discord. I'd like to have a look at it. But with that, I've been streaming for quite a while now. Now get out. Oh, fuck. I'm on the wrong page. I'm just seeing that somebody saying that he likes, Ian Duke says, I like Keith and he's very intelligent, but he did get the wrong end of the stick about AA's video. I mean, this is the trouble. He's young. I don't deny that he's got some intelligence. He's got some good points, but he needs to slow down. He needs to understand what he's talking about. He needs to understand the arguments and he needs to stop being a detriment to his own side. All right, everybody get out.